You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Louis McAllister toku ingoa, no mai haere mai. Ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahine, Monday the 29th of November. I'm your host Louis and I'll be with you for the next hour. This week on the show, I'll be speaking to Met Services Kevin Alder about new information on New Zealand's early Antarctic explorations, the University of Auckland's Dr. Rashri Roy about her research into diet during lockdown, and then a few people about the traffic light system, including the Green Party's Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri, the University of Canterbury's Michael Plank, and the Restaurant Association's Marissa Bedwar. Charlie, who's working from home, will speak to Monash University's Dr. Stella Tadic about her meta-analysis of COVID-19 transmission prevention, and advocate Omar Hamid, who will discuss the upcoming perfusionist strike. He a o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so tuku patuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 waia mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Koa ai wariwari e ahe ana koto te whakaronga ki ene kōrero ano he pakihere roki roki marunga i te pai tuku tuku o ire rangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM erakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. Remember, the text number is Rima Toru Iwa Rima, which is 5395, or you can call on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fetu Iwa, which is 309-3879. I'd love to hear your opinions today.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Auckland is expected to move to the traffic light system at 11:59 on Thursday, the 2nd of December. There's a bit of confusion over what this entails and what will happen once we move to this, so I talked to a few people. Firstly, I spoke to Michael Plank, who is at the University of Canterbury. He studies this kind of thing, and I began by asking for a general overview of what the traffic light system actually was.
When we move into the red level of the traffic light system, I think for vaccinated people, it's going to look something similar to level two that we're used to under the existing alert level system. So most things will be open, but there'll be some capacity limits. Seating, table service in restaurants, that sort of thing. However, if you're unvaccinated, it will feel more like level three. In the sense there'll be a lot of non-essential services, things like cafes, bars, gyms, that you won't be able to access if you're unvaccinated.
And for vaccinated people, what regulations are in place to do with preventative measures like masks, like social distancing, like passports?
Yeah, that's right. So masks will be mandatory in various settings, things like public transport and in shop. Obviously, we've got the vaccine passes, so we're all going to have to get used to regularly showing those vaccine passes to get into places. And as I said, yeah, there'll be some capacity limits, so places will be limited in terms of the number of people that are allowed on the premises or the number of people that can attend an event to try and reduce the potential for big super spreading type events.
And do you think that this is sufficient for protecting communities and containing COVID spread?
Well, it remains to be seen exactly how well it will work. I mean, I think it will be an effective measure. It will help reduce the risk of transmission because we know that unvaccinated people are more likely to catch the virus and to pass it on to other people. So it will reduce risk. Exactly how much it reduces the virus and slows down the spread of the virus is harder to predict, and we'll start to get a clearer picture of that once we move into the new framework.
And I guess looking forward, because obviously regions are going to be entering in either orange or red, but is there any indication as to what is required for green to go ahead? So how could Auckland enter into the green traffic light system?
I think to get to green, several things. One is going to be really good vaccination rates. That's key. Reducing the ability of the virus to spread and to make people sick. And we also need case numbers to be low in order to safely move into that green setting. And it may be that for some regions, it's not possible to move into that green setting for some time.
Have you got any predictions as to where we may be in 2 months' time?
Predictions are always tricky. It is difficult to predict, particularly more than a few weeks ahead. You know, it's possible that case numbers will sort of stutter along over the summer period, particularly once schools are on holiday, because we know that school holidays reduces a lot of the mixing transmission between children. So when schools go back February and people are going back to work, and as we move into those colder months, those things will make it easier for the virus to spread. And so it could be that that's when we see another resurgence in case numbers.
And would this compare to, because obviously in Europe they're seeing a big resurgence in case numbers there, but obviously they've got lower vaccination rates and less restrictions. Is there comparisons between what we may be implementing and what's being implemented in countries like Germany or Austria at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, even countries that have quite high vaccination rates, like Denmark, for example, are seeing, you know, quite big resurgences in case numbers. I think one of the reasons that's happening is to do with waning immunity. We know that over time, the immunity against getting infected does gradually drop off. It doesn't go away completely, and you're still protected against getting seriously ill. But that gradual waning of immunity may be one of the reasons we're seeing these resurgences in those European countries at the moment. The good news is that we're starting now to deploy booster vaccines here in New Zealand, and this is going to be crucial. This is going to be really important to keeping our collective immunity as a population as high as possible by using vaccines is by people going out and getting those booster doses. So we're going to need a really strong push on that. That's going to be one of the key measures that can keep us safe and reduce the need for further lockdowns.
So I guess with the traffic light system and with early implementation of booster shots after seeing what's happening in other countries, does this put us in much better stead than other countries, or is it still quite a high risk and quite confusing what's going to happen in the future?
I think we're in a reasonably strong position. You know, we've got quite good vaccination rates. We need them to be higher, but they're getting there slowly. We've got a sort of relatively early start on the booster program, which is good. And we're starting from a position with, you know, relatively low cases. So we're in quite a good position, but, you know, we're not going to be able to forget about the virus altogether. The pandemic hasn't finished yet, so we are going to need some of those ongoing measures, things like masks, things like testing, contact tracing, maybe some working from home at times. You know, those sorts of measures are going to be needed for some time to come.
Yeah, and I guess overall vaccination rates, looking at that as a measure, it doesn't paint a full picture. There's Māori rates are much lower than other communities. They haven't hit 90% anywhere. Is this something that the traffic light system, by being implemented now, with vaccination rates not high enough in certain communities, it kind of overlooks and ignores, and there's potential for far greater spread with open borders and looser restrictions?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, moving into this traffic light system does expose some of those communities that have low vaccination rates. And you're absolutely right. You know, looking at just the national vaccination rate or even the regional vaccination rate can mask significant gaps. And the virus is quite efficient at finding those gaps. So we do need to keep putting a lot of effort into the vaccination program, into those communities, to try and drive vaccination rates up everywhere.
So is it naive to enter the traffic light system now when these communities do not have vaccination rates that are currently high enough?
I guess we have to do it at some point, and there are always going to be trade-offs between exactly when you make that decision. You know, you can argue about what the right time would be, and from a health point of view, for protecting those communities, you know, waiting longer could potentially be a good idea. That said, you know, moving into the red level does actually provide potentially greater protection than being at level two, which is what, you know, large parts of the country are currently at. Because once you're at that red level, You've got those additional restrictions effectively on unvaccinated people, which does reduce the risk of transmission at the community level.
That was the University of Canterbury's Michael Plank. He mentioned a little bit there at the end about the risks to Māori and other vulnerable communities who are not currently at high enough vaccination rates. So to get a better gauge on this issue, I spoke to the Green Party's Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri, who is their spokesperson for health and Māori development. To begin, I asked her what the Green Party's response was to the traffic light system and whether it was too soon to be implemented.
We have always followed the advice of the science and the experts in the field, and none of the experts have endorsed this traffic light system. However, this is the circumstance we're in, and we're expecting in the Tairāwhiti to go into red because of our low vaccination numbers. We are just not seeing clearly how this links in with case numbers. We're going to have to figure out how to work with it, but as the Greens, we're not happy with it going ahead.
Yeah, and I guess could you just elaborate on the criticism from, I guess, the scientific perspective that you're noting?
Well, we have regular catch-ups with all the different experts who've been contributing advice, either formally or informally, to the government. And you know, they're often in the media speaking about it. So we have briefings with them so that we can understand what the key issues are, because none of us are scientists. And so that this should be an equitable rollout, that Māori and Pacifica are disproportionately affected, but they're more likely to get sick, we're more likely to be hospitalised and more likely to die. So all these systems that don't take that into account work against our interests, and then we're stigmatised because our numbers aren't high enough or we're holding everybody else up. And no one wants to be in that position. Everyone wants everyone to be able to see their whānau for Christmas. You know, that's really important, but all the scientific advice has been not to relax the borders in Auckland, to keep going until those numbers start coming down.
So looking ahead, ignoring what's been done and what we can't change, what would the Green Party suggest to do instead rather than move directly to the traffic light system nationwide now?
We support all of the local people who are working to get their vaccination numbers up, keep pumping resources and support into that area, that people move when it's safe to do so, and to travel. They will be spreading COVID throughout the North Island. South Island's pretty safe since you need a vaccine pass to get into the a plane or a ferry. And so that's the other key part of it is vaccine passes. People are really struggling to get them. And we know that the call centre's been overwhelmed, but they've come back with extra resources. So those things are happening, but we hope that extra resources put in to make sure that they all get rolled out before people need them.
But how long can we expect to wait? Because I've seen a lot of criticism from businesses and individuals saying that a lot of the country's already at 90%. Their businesses are struggling, the economy's struggling. What can be done? How long should we expect to wait for communities to reach 90% and where it's fully safe across the country?
I think it's fair enough concern from businesses. People are struggling. People have had to shut down. These are really, really tough times that we're in right now. Not many places are 90%, though. Not one of the DHBs have reached 90% for the Māori populations. I believe it's 11 have actually reached 90% for first doses, not for second, but for first. I think it's only one ingredient. When you look at what we need to keep safe, there's masks, there's social distancing, there's exemptions for people who can't get the vaccine. Right now, antigen testing for people who can't or haven't been vaccinated to make sure they're safe in a given situation. Vaccines are so important, but it's still only one ingredient. And another massive ingredient is number of cases. And so all we ask is that if people are travelling, they're doing so safely. They're armed with their vaccine passport because they've been double vaccinated, or they're armed with proof of a negative test. Because we also don't want to stigmatise people who are not vaccinated yet.
Yeah, that's something.
Their whole life shut down because of it.
That is something I saw you talk about. You said that the traffic light system will curtail the freedoms of the unvaccinated. But I've also seen that many people have argued that these people have had ample opportunity to get vaccinated and ample overview of the consequences. Is there not, I guess, the expectation that if you choose not to get vaccinated, this is the outcome?
I understand that lots of people's thoughts about how they look at this is based on fear and worrying about their own health, the health of our whānau, of our communities, and that's really, really valid. But the vaccine was rolled out by age, so a whole chunk of Māori only were able to get vaccinated in September. That's only two months ago. And so by that stage, misinformation is rife. Lots of people think, I'm fine, I'm healthy, I'm strong, I'll be okay. But add that up with misinformation, with the mistrust of the government, it's just kind of an ingredient. Then that far-right white supremacists, all people with all other kind of agendas have wrapped around that and trying to manipulate people. So it's not a neutral thing that we're coming into. It's not, oh, here's a vaccine. Let's all have it. The numbers are going up. People are coming in, getting vaccinated. There's going to be a hardcore that'll never probably ever get vaccinated. But there's a group still that are hesitant. When you can have good conversations with them, when they're not under pressure, that they're choosing to get vaccinated, it's just going to take a little bit more time. As I said, we're happy for people to travel if they can do that safely. We're really conscious in the Kairawhiti that we've got low rates. We've got high numbers of Māori, and it'll have a huge impact if cases come here. And no doubt they will. We just want to make sure we're as ready as we can be.
That was the Green Party's Dr. Elizabeth Kerikeri speaking about the traffic light system and what it means for Māori communities. Give us a text, give us a call, tell us what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Next up, we'll go to a quick break, and then we'll be back with an interview with the Restaurant Association's Marie Bedouard.
Classic.
What's so funny?
It's nothing. It's just something Rick said. You wouldn't get it.
Go on, try me.
It's kind of on a deeper level.
It's the weather. There's no levels.
Ooh, sounds like someone doesn't have a B card.
Enhance your listening experience with a B card. Win sick prizes, get incredible discounts, and help us to stay Auckland's best radio station since forever. Sign up for a B card from just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
I am a predator. I need to be free.
Tom Hardy returns to the big screen as Venom, one of Marvel's greatest and most complex characters.
Venus, why me?
I'm not a crazy man. I am a vengeful one.
Venom, Let There Be Carnage. Starring Tom Hardy, Michelle Williams, and featuring Woody Harrelson as Carnage. In cinemas, December 3rd. Rated M. Contains violence and offensive language.
All I ever wanted in this world... it's carnage.
We're at a dinner table in a flat.
All right, help yourself.
What's in this?
Why? What do you mean? It's good for you.
No, it's just, it tastes a bit like electro swing.
Well, it's not. I seasoned it with a little upright bass, and we had leftover jazz vocal.
Look, I'm getting takeout.
What's Cooking? Every Wednesday evening, Johnny and Big Hungry are joined on 95BFM Drive by a very special guest for great chat about extremely savoury tunes. What's Cooking? Supported by Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki. Become a member today for great art benefits.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Hope you enjoyed the break. Next up, we have an interview with the Restaurant Association. Restaurants across Auckland will be opening for seated and indoor dining as New Zealand enters the traffic light system. These restrictions will be similar to level 2, including social distancing and mask wearing indoors, as well as vaccine passports. I spoke to the Restaurant Association's Marissa Bedouard about their expectations for reopening and what these restrictions entail. To begin, I asked what it would look like at restaurants under the red traffic light system.
Well, for Auckland businesses, it will mean being able to open up our front doors again. So the industry are very excited about being able to move into this new system and be able to trade a little bit more freely than we have been. It's really a welcome opportunity for our businesses to start trading again as they normally would. There are still some restrictions, of course, in red light. It's quite similar to some of the restrictions we've seen at level 2 in the past.
How will restaurants operate under the red traffic light system?
Many of our restaurants will be having a system in place where they will be checking your vaccine passes. Those businesses that have those systems in place will essentially be operating like they would be at level 2 in many cases. So we'll see tables that are separated, diners will need to be seated, but essentially, other than that, it will be reasonably business as usual. In other words, the main differences you will see or that you will need to be aware of is that you will need to be seated In the restaurant, you will also be separated, so there will be some separation between tables. And mask use will be, you know, it's expected that people will wear masks, but of course, when you're eating, you won't be wearing your mask if you're seated at the table. So,
has the messaging to restaurants been clear enough from governments? What response has there been from restaurant owners and workers?
Look, we have had quite a bit of, I guess, a challenge in getting all the information that we need as businesses to be able to operate. And in fact, we are actually having a hospitality-specific update from the DPMC, which is the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. They're giving us a briefing specifically for hospitality today. So that will be a really great opportunity for our businesses to get some clarity and for us at the Restaurant Association to ensure that we have all the information we need to be assisting our members to opening up their businesses and ensuring they have everything they need.
So is there still a little bit of confusion among owners over what they can and can't do under the red traffic light system?
Yes, there is. And we're still seeking confirmation on a few areas as well. But we understand
specifically, what are some of these areas?
I was just going to say that we understand generally what our requirements are, but there is still some confusion in the areas in terms of scanning passports, for example. We've heard a few different scenarios that in one case, we were told that they needed to be scanned in the front door or in the vicinity of the entrance. In another sort of official update, we heard that, well, indeed, this could be essentially created by the business. They may have their customers sitting down before they scan their passport, or in some cases, they could even do some checks before, the guests arrived into their establishment as well. So today, we're hoping to get some clarity around exactly what the expectations are and some clarity around what the policy is for those vaccine passes.
And obviously, there is a little bit of issues among confusion that you mentioned, but has there been stress or worries among restaurant owners about cases still remaining relatively high while they still have to open their doors to keep business flowing?
Many of the business owners that I've spoken to are very happy that we're able to open. And feel confident that the measures that are being put in place will be enough to keep themselves and their teams safe. So I haven't heard anyone sort of raising any concerns about the high number of cases in the community. It's been more around being good news that they can open their businesses.
And has the mandate had much of an impact on restaurants and how they look to open with seated dining and everything, especially with staff that may not be vaccinated that will have to resign or something like that?
I've definitely had conversations with business owners that are working through their processes with the vaccine mandates for their teams. And in some cases, it has been very stressful for the business owners going through those processes with their team. You know, in some cases where there have been vaccine hesitant employees, it is challenging to work through the requirements and the processes with those people. So it hasn't been an easy process for our businesses.
Are business owners still expecting good turnout from consumers into the traffic light system, even though I've seen that a lot of businesses said that going into level 3 and level 2 following level 4, there wasn't as much support as they expected?
With our Auckland businesses, we are in what is traditionally a very busy time for our businesses, with the Christmas kind of celebrations happening and the corporates taking their teams out. We have had some indication that many of our members have taken forward bookings over this time, so many are planning on being busier over the next couple of weeks. But the main concern around our businesses at the moment is they'll have a couple of busy weeks and then everyone will head away for the summer break, so we're kind of heading into a quieter period for Auckland as many Aucklanders head away for their summer holidays. So we're confident that there'll be a couple of weeks that we'll be busy in our businesses, but who knows what will happen after that.
Yeah, I guess the reintroduction of borders will probably have quite an impact. Is there also expectations of people coming into Auckland and huge benefits from that?
We haven't heard as many reports about people coming into Auckland. I think there is still some hesitancy around visitors coming to our city. That's sort of some of the information that we've heard from, our businesses and other areas. So We're not 100% sure how many visitors we will see to the city. And even if we can look at past summers where we have traditionally in the city, we will experience a bit of a lull after Christmas, right through oftentimes until the end of January. That is sort of what many of our businesses are planning for.
But I guess overall it's quite an exciting time for restaurant owners.
Overall, it is. Businesses are really happy to be open, to be lifting those restrictions a bit more, and hopefully getting into a time where they can be welcoming their customers back into their business. So all in all, businesses are feeling optimistic.
That was the Restaurant Association's Marissa Bidois speaking about Auckland restaurants reopening in the traffic light system.
So around, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Apex Union clinical perfusionists plan to strike in Auckland this week over the government's pay freeze for high earners. As perfusionists are specialist medical machinery operators, public concern came over the limited number of perfusionists available during surgery. Omar Hamid, an advocate for the group, spoke with Charlie about the aims of the strike and why the public should not fear health worker strikes. Charlie started by asking what the strike is hoping to achieve.
Perfusionists have given notice of strike action on the 3rd and the 2nd and the 3rd of December. Further strike notices will go in for the 13th of December, and there will be further strikes notified for the 14th of December as well.
What are these strikes hoping to achieve?
Perfusionists, they are health professionals who operate cardiac bypass machines. So when patients are having surgery on their heart, typically they will need their blood to be circulated and oxygenated artificially. And so there are two different machines that perfusionists use to achieve that. One is the cardiac bypass machine, and the second is the ECMO machine, which is an extracorporeal membrane oxygenation system. And all surgery on the heart requires perfusionists to be in theatre circulating and oxygenating the blood to allow the surgeons to work on the heart and uninterrupted by the blood and to keep those patients alive. So perfusionists are highly trained, highly skilled health professionals who operate in these cardiothoracic surgical teams that around New Zealand, and we have 20 of them at Auckland Hospital. And you may remember the government's public sector pay freeze for high earners. Now they have all been affected by that, so the majority of them will not receive a pay rise this year because of the government's pay freeze. We understand what the government is trying to do with lifting low income earners. But what we are saying is that we think a sensible compromise is for Auckland DHB to raise the employer contributions to our members' KiwiSavers schemes in stages from 3%, which is the minimum employer contribution, to 6%, which would be about half of what Australian perfusionists or all Australian employees get from Australian employers.
So this isn't a direct salary benefit, this is sort of a future KiwiSaver.
Yeah, so the Public Service Commission has this pay freeze policy for those earning over $100,000, which are the majority of our perfusionists, but they also have a policy of consistency in the public sector. Now, we know that some medical professionals already get 6% superannuation, for example, senior medical officers. Other parts of the public sector, so firefighters get 6% superannuation, police officers get employer contributions around about 12%. Academics at universities get contributions from their employers around about 5.5%. And when Michael Cullen brought in the KiwiSaver Act, the original intention was to lift both employee and employer contributions in stages up to 4%. Now that has never happened, but we think there are really good benefits to society at large in terms of increasing employer contributions to our members' KiwiSaver accounts. One is it helps first home buyers, and we know that our younger members who are newer to the profession are struggling to put together deposits to buy their first home. And second, we know that we want to attract health professionals from overseas Currently, the KiwiSaver Act prevents health professionals who are on work visas from joining KiwiSaver and getting a employer contribution to their KiwiSaver scheme. Our compromise would allow employers to contribute to alternative superannuation schemes for migrant workers. And thirdly, New Zealand has one of the lowest rates of retirement savings in the OECD. We know that people are living longer and expecting a more comfortable retirement. Increasing both employee and employer contributions to KiwiSaver is one of the ways to do that.
So it sounds like there's definitely a lot of benefits to the perfectionists. I think where people's concerns come in is obviously they're highly trained professionals and there's only a certain amount of people who can do this during heart surgeries. So when people might be missing out on surgeries on the strike days, what would you have to say to them?
So if we take a step back for a second, all strike action in the health sector involves a conflict between two fundamental rights. So one is the right of workers to take strike action, and the second is the right of New Zealanders to access free public health care. And related to that is their right to life and preservation of their life. How the conflict between those two rights are managed in the health sector is through a process whereby we as the union and the employer, in this case, Auckland District Health Board, every time a strike notice is issued, we are required to work through together and agree life-preserving services. So for perfusionists, we supply, every time our members are on strike, the elective work stops. So that's the operations which can be delayed are delayed, but we supply four perfusionists over the course of the strike action who are on immediate standby for any urgent emergency work. So if someone's heart, there is an aortic dissection, for example, a perfusionist is immediately available to assist with that. And as well as, so perfusionists at Auckland DHB are the only perfusionists in the country who work with paediatric patients. If there are paediatric patients that need emergency surgery during a strike, they are provided the life-preserving care that they need by our members. And perfusionists at Auckland DHB also operate the National Transplant Service. So you need perfusionists to oxygenate and circulate blood through donor hearts, lungs, and livers. And we continue to supply perfusionists to allow the National Transplant Service to get hearts, lungs, and livers from donors to donees. So that's how we manage that conflict. And it is a conflict between our members' right to take strike action and the public's right to healthcare. In the end, no health professional wants to be taking industrial action, but circumstances of the government's pay freeze and the negotiating position of the DHB has left us with no choice but to take this last resort action and try and shift their position as our members' fundamental right.
That was Apex perfusionist advocate Omar Hamid speaking with Charlie about their upcoming strike.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Sorry, I'm just looking for where I've saved this. Here we are. Met Service has discovered logbooks related to New Zealand's early expeditions to Antarctica. These logbooks relate to expeditions on the Terra Nova and Aurora ships by Ernest Shackleton and Captain Robert Falcon Scott in the 1910s. They include information about weather conditions, flora and fauna, and provide information that has not been seen for over 50 years. I spoke to Met Service's Kevin Alder about the logbooks, some of the information in them, and why it was personally important to him. I began by asking for an overview of why these logbooks are significant.
So the documents we've found are a series of books, which are logs of weather records from the vessels concerned, the Terra Nova and the Aurora, for a period of approximately a month each during particular voyage, section of their voyages, in either to Antarctica or on their journey to Antarctica from, in the case of Terra Nova, from the United Kingdom.
Do these change much about our perceptions of early explorations of Antarctica by New Zealanders?
I think they're, I wouldn't say they would change anything. I think what they do is they just fill in a lot more detail that was perhaps missing in the past. You know, weather is one of those ubiquitous things that is always present wherever you are. And so while we know that ships travelled down into Antarctic regions, to actually have the measurements taken on board at the time really gives additional context to those voyages. So
what specific details that have been provided by these logbooks really stood out to you? Which ones really piqued your interest?
In particular, the log from the Shackleton vessel, the Aurora. They were sailing south to Ross Island to rescue a team of men who had been stuck down there for 2 years. The day they arrived at the location where these men were was on January the 10th, 1917. I can see here from the record that what the weather was on the day, and what's really interesting is that written in the ship's log, it says things such as smoke observed from Mount Erebus, which is the active volcano down there, and other things such as many killer whales, penguins near the ship. So as well as weather observations where the air temperature was approximately 0 degrees Celsius, very light winds, scattered clouds, so quite a fine but cold day, you get this additional information to do with things like the flora and fauna. And in addition to the weather observations, that's the thing that gets me here, reading the logs.
So given that these were found in a storage room, why haven't they been found earlier?
We'd probably have to go back 40 or 50 years, I think, to when people in the organisation were probably last aware of them. We don't necessarily go into an archive room and look for these documents, because you can imagine we've been storing a lot of information over the years, and these are just two documents in what is effectively a very large library of documents in storage.
So how did these come to be, in your view? How did you find out about them?
Publicly known that we're moving out of this building, and so part of the need to move out is to clear out all our documents and things. And so we were going through an exercise of just sorting through what was in the room, and these two books were brought to me. This is when we made that discovery that they're actually quite historic and quite important in terms of Antarctic exploration.
And for you personally, does this discovery have much personal importance? What does it mean for you?
One of the things that has drove me to take up a career in meteorology, of all things, was my very early reading of history around Antarctic explorations. I've read extensively about Robert Falcon Scott and Amundsen, who was the Norwegian explorer who first made it to South Pole, as well as Shackleton and his exploits. So for me personally, it was quite an amazing find to see that there are documents tied to two men who sort of motivated me to take on this career. Yeah, so quite personal, actually.
And do you expect that there's probably a lot more documents that haven't been seen for years that have the same importance as these ones?
Well, we haven't found any of a similar magnitude to this in terms of Antarctic exploration, and particularly the names of two famous ships, but we are finding other documents that are very interesting in their records.
And what have some of these said?
We have a lot of early satellite photos from the 1960s, so very early satellite imagery of weather systems. We've found some early climatological summaries, which of course are relevant in terms of the weather from 1940 as opposed to what we have now. Another find that we had is a series of aerial photographs of around the Antarctic Dry Valleys region, which is very close to where Scott Base is, and those date from the late 1950s. So I think some of these things are going to be quite interesting for people to look through in terms of research and so on.
That was Met Services Kevin Older speaking about newfound logbooks relating to New Zealand's early Antarctic expeditions. We will go to a quick break at the moment. Give us a text on 5395. We'd love to hear your thoughts, know what you're thinking about these pieces, know what's up with your day. We'll be back with a piece from Charlie after the break. See you soon.
Whether you need gifts for family and friends, delicious food to fill out Christmas lunch, or add a table centrepiece, you'll find everything you need for a fantastic festive season at Scarecrow. Part of the Sustainable Business Network, the majority of Scarecrow stock is New Zealand made, so you can feel good about what you're buying. Scarecrow, kitchen, florist, grocer. Open 7 days a week in two locations, Victoria Street East by Albert Park and 811 Mount Eden Road. Or shop online at scarecrow.co.nz.
The Billboard Hot 100.
Pitchfork's top 200 songs of the 1990s.
The Rock 2000.
All of them little piss babies, unable to compare to the one show, the only show with the guff to shove it to the man at his house where he lives.
The 95 BFM Top 10. The best show, the best songs, the best hosts. Annabelle and Callum, taking you through the best radio station in the world's toppest top tracks of the week.
The 95 BFM Top 10, 7 to 9 p.m. every Wednesday. Vote online at 95bfm.com/vote.
It's fucked.
We've conducted a systematic review, which is a big study of multiple studies in which we wanted to look into the effectiveness of a range of different public health measures in reducing incidence of COVID-19 and also the transmission of the virus. So pretty much we've screened over 35,000 papers, and there were not many high quality studies that we could involve that would meet the inclusion criteria.
Sorry about that one, jumped the gun. I'll give you a quick intro for that piece now, just after the break. So here we are. This is from Charlie. Despite COVID-19 being a rapidly changing virus, there is still limited research around preventing transmission rates. Dr. Stella Talich, an epidemiologist at Monash University, has led a recent meta-analysis into which preventative measures have proved most effective across the world. One of the most prevalent statistics found in the study was that mask wearing could reduce transmission rates by up to 53% in certain areas. Dr. Talich spoke with Charlie, who started by asking what the study involved and what limitations were found.
We've conducted a systematic review, which is a big study of multiple studies in which we wanted to look into the effectiveness of a range of different public health measures in reducing incidence of COVID-19 and also the transmission of the virus. So pretty much we've screened over 35,000 papers, and there were not many high quality studies that we could involve that would meet the inclusion criteria. 8 studies in particular were involved in meta-analysis, which is a quantitative sort of analysis where we combine all the data from the total number of studies and then we see what's the overall effect of the intervention. I have to say that studies were limited. Most of them were observational, which means that there was not a lot of experimental and interventional aspect to these studies. They do have their own limitations, as we all know, and it's very often very hard to understand what's the real effect and causative factor of the intervention, given that some of them were retrospective. So in that case, we don't know what occurred first, whether the intervention or the outcome. So that's one of the major limitations. However, there was a randomized controlled trial, so an experimental design that has confirmed that face masks are effective. Those particular results were not statistically significant. Having said that, those results do point to a clinical or public health significance of the effectiveness of face masks. Overall, the 3 measures that we were able to quantitatively assess, we found that there is association with the efficacy in those interventions to reduce COVID-19 incidence. However, we have to be mindful that that evidence is still limited, and we do need more experimental studies to confirm those results, which I believe there are another 2 randomized controlled trials that are on the way. And hopefully they will confirm the same results that we found.
So was the mask wearing reduction the most prevalent finding from your study, or were there other findings?
Yeah, mask wearing and physical distance, and also hand washing, although we do believe that there is effect probably coming from a bundle of measures or combination of measures, because it could be simply that people who tend to wash their hands more frequently, they're also the ones that wearing the masks and being more compliant and adherent to other measures. That's something that we could not really work out from the data we had. However, those 3 measures seem to be associated with the reduction, so they seem to be working. But as I said in the paper, we need further experimental research and further investments into public health overall to be able to test those measures and confirm and inform health policy.
So if the mask wearing reduction continued to provide the same evidence, would this be something that government should look into mandating?
I can't really say about mandating. I would definitely say that it should be recommended for people. We definitely know that there is some effect. It may not be as big as we've seen from observational data, but a lot of researchers and scientists would agree that very often in observational studies, we see the effect being overestimated. So this occurred probably in our review as well, given that, you know, studies that we've included were mostly of observational nature. These measures are cheap, they're sustainable, and they don't do any harm, and therefore I would definitely say that, you know, given the variants that we're currently seeing in the virus and given the, you know, areas in the world where vaccination uptake is not really high, these interventions should really stay alongside vaccination as one of the, you know, main preventative measures.
So for just individuals trying to reduce transmission, is that the best course of recommendation for them?
From the current evidence that we've got, which, as I said, it's limited, we believe so, yes. In areas in which you cannot physically distance, in closed space, in areas where there is low vaccination uptake, and in areas with high population density, based on our findings, we do believe that additional measures to vaccination, such as the ones that we've investigated, so washing your hands frequently, physically distance if you can, you know, from people, especially those that have symptoms, and also wearing a mask is very important.
I saw as well from your study, it looked at large population groups like the US and the UK. Yep. Is there a possibility that in smaller populations, the reduction rates could be higher?
It's a very good question and a very hard one, I have to say. We don't know just because of the limitations of the study. Some of them were surveys in which they've asked people retrospectively, were you wearing masks at that time? And where, you know, they tried to track how they behaved. So it's very hard to say that the same reduction or bigger reduction would be seen in smaller areas. I can't really directly answer to that. But what we know from experimental studies is that, and even the ones that are coming from Bangladesh, for example, at the moment, where they've done experimental study in high population densities and also in some smaller villages and areas in Bangladesh, they've seen reduction in the spread of COVID and incidence of COVID with wearing masks. Although it was a lot smaller than what we found in our study, there was still some level of protection, which is very promising.
So as it was noted, there are a few limitations of how much evidence is available at the moment. Moving forward in sort of global analysis research of COVID-19, will this play a big part in determining which reduction strategies are more effective and should be used?
I think this study will definitely inform some further developments. I think that the public health measures or non-pharmaceutical measures, they do have central importance in pandemic control, especially when we talk about respiratory virus. And COVID-19 has been a quite challenging virus as there is a lot of asymptomatic people which also transmit it. So having a good public health response and public health measures that are implemented in the population, it's really crucial. What is really striking is that lack of investment in public health measures. There was just around 4% of global research funding that has gone into COVID-19, and there is very limited research into public health measures, and that's really surprising. So I'm hoping that this study will directly inform, you know, relevant authorities that we really need to invest more. We need to look at the barriers to why people are not conducting such studies. So I'm talking about scientists and researchers across the world. But I have to say that there is a positive development from a recent initiative by the World Health Organization, which sort of calls out to strengthen the global evidence to provide more actionable and evidence-informed guidance on those measures for decision makers, which is crucial.
That was Dr. Stella Talich from Monash University speaking with Charlie about her new COVID-19 study.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
Haywire.
Recent research has found that our diets are much worse during lockdown than in normal conditions. By surveying people across New Zealand, it claims that people eat almost 60% more comfort foods during lockdown, especially due to stress and anxiety. I spoke to one of the researchers, the University of Auckland's Dr. Rashri Roy, about how lockdown impacts diet and what the government could do. To start, I asked her to give a brief overview of what they found out.
We conducted the survey called the COVID CHI survey, where we surveyed about 3,000 New Zealanders. But this was done April 24th to May 13th last year, so this is a 2020 lockdown survey. when New Zealand was at alert level 3 and 4, and the COVID Kai survey was an online questionnaire which assessed cooking and shopping behaviours among New Zealanders. But this particular research was published recently, examined how sources of our food choice inspiration, so things like cooking-related advice and the reasons for recipe selection, are related to dietary patterns both before and during lockdown.
And for during lockdown, what did it find?
During lockdown, of the about 3,000 participants, those who were what were their influences like? We saw that in lockdown in particular was related to people increasing their comforting recipes as a reason for recipe selection. So about 76% of respondents said that they are selecting more comforting recipes and comfort foods, and that was associated with a higher scoring in unhealthy dietary patterns during lockdown.
And one of the things you guys said may have been an indicator of why people chose comfort food was things like stress and other things related to mental health during lockdown. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
We already know from previous research that shaping of food choices often happens at home, and usually family is widely recognized as significant in food decisions. And a lot of the things we saw that when we're isolated, we tend to go for the comforting recipes, because it's important, you know, to be kind to ourselves during the pandemic and eat foods that we enjoy for our mental health. But on the other hand, proper nutrition helps to keep our bodies functioning well and protect our physical health. But the simple carbohydrates and added sugars and saturated fat and salt that are often present in high levels in comfort meals and snacks can be less healthy, especially when the periods of lockdown are extended, and we have extended periods of lockdown and therefore extended periods of comfort eating. So that's where this becomes a problem. But otherwise, you know, we understand why the increased levels of stress would lead to people going for more of the energy-dense foods that gives them that comfort and that reassurance for their mental health. But it's all about being that mindfulness around, well, if it's going to be extended periods of lockdown, how do we go about balancing that?
Did people give specific examples and reasons of why they chose comfort food during lockdown?
So this particular study didn't assess that, but the broader survey did look at asked people about their mental health and their quality of life. And people did comment on how their mental health was suffering in long periods of social isolation. Most of the respondents commented on changes in employment and things like that. Later on, if we, assess more of the survey data, we would be able to sort of show some correlations between people's mental health and their choices of food.
Were there many changes moving beyond level 4 lockdown, especially into level 3 where there were fast food options, or into level 2 and 1 where people had more freedom and more opportunities to do other stuff?
Yeah, so we looked at level 4 and level 3. So essentially most of the stuff was around the first part of the survey sort of questioned around what happened during level 4. And then in level 3, we sort of asked around, well, how have, your intake changed? And I guess a lot of the respondents also commented on comfort foods, not just for cooking recipes, but also comfort foods in the sense of ordering more takeaways when it came to level 3. So there was that slight shift. But a lot of the survey sort of looked at the whole of lockdown as a whole, as opposed to separating level 4, level 3. But we could see some indications around more takeaways, more comforting foods in takeaway orders that respondents reported.
And I guess, obviously, this is something you said the government may need to take action on in their pandemic response plan. What specific things could government and could public health officials look to do to reduce the impacts of comfort eating during lockdowns?
So some of the things that we sort of talked about in our study was that a lot of public health messaging around during the pandemic response have been around, well, you should get out for walks and you should get out for exercise. But there haven't been any public health messaging around, well, what should you be eating and how should you be more mindful about the foods that you're eating? And I think going forward, if we are going to have different type of social distancing measures and extended periods of lockdown, it becomes imperative for public health advocates and the government to have public health messaging that are relevant around food and how to incorporate food in the lives
when you're, you know, when you're stuck in lockdown, and a lot more, efforts around educating people and creating awareness around what should we eat and how should we eat when we are, stuck in long periods of lockdowns.
But is there a bit of a potential for almost information overload where people are already stressed about lockdowns and all the things having to do with COVID, and they're told that they should be not eating this stuff, and comfort food's almost just a thing to relax themselves?
Yeah, so I think there, again, like, it needs to come a bit of a balance. I think there needs to be more positive nutrition messaging as opposed to negative nutrition messaging. Like, we're not asking people to stop eating something. It's more about, well, how can we incorporate more healthier foods in our diet while we're sitting at home, and having that, you know, helping people strike that balance. And I think the messaging should be around, well, not just, you know, go for a walk, you know, why don't you, you know, add some veggies to your meal kind of thing. So I think, yeah, you're right in terms of, like, understanding where people are at in terms of their mental health, and understanding why comfort foods are important, you know, to help with the mental health, but also having some positive nutrition messaging so that we're not being detrimental to other aspects of our physical health.
That was the University of Auckland's Rashri Roy speaking about people's diets during lockdown.
That was The Wire.
Thank you to everyone that spoke with us today on the show. That was, well, it was a show, I guess. And anyway, thanks to Charlie from doing his stuff from home. We'll see you next week. See you later.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.